This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Franklin Foer. He is the editor of The New Republic, one of the great periodicals in the United States of America. And he is also author of the now classic work, How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization, which we will talk about shortly. And he also, on the New Republic website, has organized a blog that has run the course of the World Cup called Goalpost, and you can find that at the website tnr.com, and you'll find the link to it on the right-hand side of the front page of the New Republic website, which is tnr.com. So if you are right now having withdrawal from the World Cup and you want to go back and read some great writing about the tournament that has now completed, I do recommend going to tnr.com and checking out the blog Goalpost if you haven't seen it already. Some great writing there. Franklin Foer, welcome to The People's Game.
Thanks so much.
Well, how are you doing? That's the first question. Are you experiencing withdrawal?
I've got the shakes. Yeah, I've got the shakes. I've been bedridden. I'm at a loss about what to do with the rest of my life. So I've just decided that I'm going to start gearing up for the next World Cup. I got my family on board for doing a massive road trip to Brazil in 2014. So I have that to look forward to.
Well, we at the People's Game are in dialogue with people who are trying to organize a global, worldwide, one-month holiday in 2014.
Sign me up as John Hancock to that petition.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the tournament itself. I thought your posting yesterday in the wake of the final was really on point about Spain winning the tournament. So let's go right to the games on the field. What did you make of the final, and what do you make of Spain as the 2010 World Cup champions?
I didn't love the final. It was choppy. It was a lot of opportunities blown. It never really developed the rhythm that you'd expect, and Spain never really was able to fully engage in their tiki-taka short passing game, which, you know, a lot of people argue that it's boring, but I love it. I mean, I just love watching the skill, the anticipation, the coordination. It's not a muscular game, but it's, I don't know any other way to describe it other than artistry. And so, you know, I wish Spain was able to put together some sort of magisterial performance in the final game that capped off this great run that they've had as a nation in the sport, and they weren't able to do that. But I would argue that their triumph in this tournament was basically a lifetime achievement award for the Spaniards, that over the course of the last couple of years, between the European Championship, between Barcelona's run in club-level soccer, and this tournament, they deserved to triumph. They're the best team in the world. And I hope that they're able to keep everything together and triumph in the European Championship in 2 years. I'm not sure that they're going to be able to hold the team together until 2014. Xavi, who is the integral component in this team, is going to be 34, and he's hinted that he doesn't think he can make it all the way to the next World Cup at the international level. So they deserve it. They've instigated a tactical revolution in the game. They've played beautiful soccer, and I'm happy for them.
Actually, I also really love your article on the website about Puyol. I was somewhat aware that he had, you know, had sort of an up-and-down period in recent years, but wasn't aware that he was so close to sort of falling off the radar screen, as your essay explained. And so he's really made a comeback, but it seems very unlikely that he'll be able to be around.
Yeah,
say, by
I know. He's old. I think he's like 32, 33. And I just have a hard time seeing him making it even to the next European Championship. And he was very vulnerable yesterday. I mean, he was lucky not to get a red card for that, tugging on Ian Robin in the way that he did. And just the fact that he was able to pull it together as well as he did for this tournament was a remarkable achievement. I mean, he's never been a fast guy, but he's always had incredible positional sense, and he's always run as hard as he possibly can. I mean, he's one of these guys who wears his heart on his sleeve, and that's what makes him such a good player and such a lovable player.
Actually, I want to say a few things about Ian Robin here. For a guy who was accused of taking so many dives, it almost seems like Robin's a brilliant, brilliant player, but he's not all that tactically wise sometimes. The one time he really should have probably hit the dirt,
yeah, right,
you know,
exactly,
and Puyol would have gotten a red card. He'd already had a yellow, so there was so there was no doubt he would have left the game. They would have been 11-10 and probably would have swung the match right there.
You know, Robin, I put Robin in the same category as Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, player who is undeniably brilliant and plays in a pretty arrogant sort of way. And it's impossible not to take some pleasure in the way that both Ronaldo and Robin play. Yet you kind of want them to add up to something more than they actually are. And they're both arrogant to the point at which they don't really pass as much as they should. And also, you know, they think every time they get touched, the defender should be ejected from the game. And so they do a lot of flopping and dramatizing and whining, and they're just not the most pleasant players to watch.
My take on Spain is they were the best team in the world right now, especially when you take into consideration that they didn't have the opportunity with Torres, clearly hobbled. Was betrayed as a reality in the final moments of the match yesterday, that they couldn't have the two offensive threats up front. Then the defense would have been spread more, both Villa and Torres would have had more opportunities with Xavi and Iniesta slotting through passes. And, you know, 8 goals in 7 games.
The one thing I would say is that tactically it's never been – there's always been some issue with Villa and Torres linking up. That you remember back to the qualifying for Euro 2008, it took a while for Luis Aragonés to figure out how to make those two coexist in a way that – they didn't end up encroaching on each other's spaces and canceling each other out. So there was, you know, I thought that Torres was clearly hobbled. Really, Del Bosque did the right thing in sitting him for the semi and the final. But here's the one thing that I would say is, initially everybody argued that Torres was slowing down the team, but then when they took out Torres, it's not like David Villa went on a massive scoring spree.
Right.
I don't think that he scored any more goals without Torres in the starting lineup.
Yeah, they did seem to get in each other's way occasionally. But then with a player of Fabregas's quality on the bench, too, it's clear that in terms of depth and talent, this is the superior side in the world right now. And a theme I want to touch on very shortly is the ways in which players still care more about the World Cup, or at least most players seem to care more about the World Cup than anything else. And that had some interesting nuance, that issue. But before going there, I want to ask your thoughts on the Dutch team, because they've been criticized in their national media for being so pragmatic, for being so unpretty. And I can only imagine that today the Dutch press must be having a field day on that issue, because here they finally had full center stage, and they played the ugliest match I've ever seen in the history of my watching the Dutch football team. I mean, De Jong and...
I completely agree with that. But I don't think that that's necessarily the reaction in Holland today. I think that they're engaging in a lot of self-pity and victimization. I think that they're blaming Howard Webb for enforcing the game too tightly and then failing to make several crucial calls in their favor. Now, not just the Puyol Robin interchange that we discussed, but there were two corner kicks that clearly should have gone Holland's way that were not given to them, and several other little minor incidents across the game. And I think that the Dutch players after the match felt horribly aggrieved by the referee's performance, and so I think that's what Holland is grasping onto. But there will be people. Ruud Gullit, after the match, was complaining that the players had basically brought shame onto the country for their hard tactics and for playing in such a cynical, violent sort of way. And so I hope that the Dutch feel some sort of sense of shame and introspection over their performance yesterday.
It's an interesting, I imagine, mindset they must being, because in many respects, you know, if you look at Ajax and FC Barcelona, they generate so much talent out of their youth systems. Ajax is now, because of financial issues, which we'll again touch on, related to your book, the How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization, Ajax has gone from being one of the dominant sides in Europe to being one of the better sides in a minor league now, because now Ajax can't compete with the big money teams for a variety of reasons, mainly having to do with finances, but they still generate a ton of players. and the style of play that Barcelona and Spain have adopted comes straight out of the history of Dutch soccer. And yet, at center stage, Holland, people were calling this Holland versus Holland, but the real Holland was the team wearing the Spanish uniform. So it'll be interesting to see how that side evolves and whether they'll no longer have these sort of pitball holding midfielders and two of them. Like they did, because it really, with De Jong and Van Bommel, really made it sort of an ugly match. What do you make of Diego Forlán as the player of the tournament? I was very happy to see that and not to just defer to it someone from one of the final two teams, because I thought he really was the player of the tournament.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, he had one of the great runs, and it was just, he had a great season with Atletico Madrid in addition to having a fantastic tournament for Uruguay, but he really carried that team. And he was probably the only player in the tournament to really master the Jabalani, which I do think had a really pernicious effect on play in this tournament. I think that when we look back at this tournament and look back at how few goals were scored and how badly great impresarios of the ball performed on set pieces, I think we'll say that Adidas really did a huge disservice to the game by imposing that ball in the tournament.
I'm speaking with Franklin Foyer. He's the author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. He is the editor of the New Republic magazine, where there was the blog Goalpost, which he contributed to, along with a number of other very sharp commentators on the 2010 World Cup. I want to talk just for a second about the World Cup versus club soccer with the framing of what your perception is about which competition the players care more for, because it struck me, if you look at the Nike ad, and there was a lot written about the Inarritu-directed Nike ad, Inarritu, a great Mexican director, featuring the sort of top global superstars going into the 2010 World Cup, and it was viewed as sort of like a curse. Everyone, one by one, they sort of fell by the wayside. Drogba was gone, Cannavaro was gone, Ronaldinho didn't even make the tournament, Cristiano Ronaldo was gone by the second round. The last player standing from the players featured, Wayne Rooney, had a horrible tournament. And the English side, again, there was a lot of written in the English press about these guys are bloated millionaires, they just don't care. But then you got to the final, and I felt a lot of what was taking place on the final with this strategy of the holding midfielders in Holland was this real sense that they were going to not want to make a mistake, and that the level of caring was so great, there was so much invested emotionally in the outcome of this game, that it sort of clogged and clotted the field up, and a very conservative approach to soccer was taken, even from sides that traditionally had a lot of flow, and particularly with the Dutch. And, you know, you look at Manchester United, Barcelona, the top club sides in recent years, and I was thinking, my word, you know, Alex Ferguson's Manchester United, at least 2007, 2008 team, or 2008, 2019, would slaughter the Spanish side. Aren't they really the best team in the world, Manchester United or Barcelona, the ones that get to pull from around the world and complement their core with superstars from around the world? And then I thought, well, no, actually, I don't know about that, because I think what is making the Spanish side and this Dutch side sort of feel so congested is the amount of just caring and passion for it, the outcome of the World Cup. It so clearly is more important than the club side outcomes to these players, as much as they care about those. And this is interesting, because
I agree with that in large part. Although I would argue that for Barcelona, you have a lot of the same commitment to the jersey that you have for the Spanish national team, and a lot of it has to do with I think what you're saying, where in part players are just when you put on the national jersey, you know you're going. You're kind of, to use the martial metaphor, a warrior on behalf of your country, and you know that that part of it is just the frequency of these tournaments. It happens once every 4 years, and I think that just adds to. I mean, it's an obvious fact about a World Cup, but I think it's the key fact, because if you screw up, it haunts you for a very long period, and you know as a player that you're not going to play in very many of these, and you got to make the most of it. And so it just, I think it leads to the some of the stilted play, and I think it leads to some of the over dramatization of penalties, because everybody's trying to get every little single advantage that they can because the stakes are so darn high. But just to go back to, you know, I'm a Barca fan, and I think one of the things that Barcelona has done is they have an academy that develops local kids from Catalonia and takes them and builds them into this system, and it's a system that Spain has ironically embraced as their own tactical system for playing with their national side. I think that other clubs would be wise to try to imitate what Barcelona has done, and other countries would be wise to imitate that too. I mean, I think that that's what the Germans did so well, was they built a youth system that was centered around the national team and creating a generation of players who had chemistry and a similar understanding of the game. And you can't underestimate how significant that is.
Well, certainly heading into the Euro tournament in 2012, one would have to think that the side that would be tipped to compete with Spain would not necessarily be Holland, but would be Germany and, you know, France, Italy, and England look a shambles.
Absolutely right.
And Portugal, you know, a lot of the supporting cast for Cristiano Ronaldo are very old, actually, and will be gone, Carvalho and so on. He's a little isolated. There was a golden generation that he wasn't a part of earlier. Again, related to your theory and how soccer explains the world, what strikes me at the end of the World Cup is now we're two decades in from the creation of the Premiership, the Sky Satellite Sports, the Berlusconi Satellite TV, this sort of explosion of club soccer being available for consumption all around the world, followed so closely all around the world. But it strikes me that the World Cup, a combination of the heart that the players put into it, the attention that people around the world give it, still far exceeding the attention given to club soccer, plus national pride, that trumps money. It doesn't matter that these guys are basically being paid sort of a set wage that is nothing compared to what they're paid for their club sides. This is more important. They're going to put their soul, their bodies right on the line for this tournament in ways that you just don't see. I mean, you see it in the club soccer, but not at this level of passion. So I think that's an interesting thing about where soccer...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And what's your reflection on that?
Absolutely. And it's something I find heartening that that in this world that their values and commitments that trump paychecks, and that really just knowing how much your countrymen care about the outcome of this tournament is part of the reason that players play so hard and will do everything that they can to win it. And I think it is in a way the single most globalized event in all of human existence, yet that it doesn't have and let's not be naive. I mean, money is a huge part of the tournament and the spectacle, but I think at the end of the day, players aren't motivated by money, and so to have that at the core of this fundamentally globalized experience is something that I find pretty heartening.
For those who've been listening to the People's Game radio show and following the sort of line that we've taken on soccer, its relationship to global culture, the sort of point we are at in human history, as it were, you can only imagine that the book How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization, is something that all of us who've participated in this show have sort of seen ourselves as building upon. But for those people who are unfamiliar with the central thesis of the book, Franklin Foer, your book from, I believe, 2004 was originally published, can you explain how you use soccer as a framing to explain and shed illumination on globalization?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the backstory to the book is that I was a fan of the game, and I'm also a political journalist. And so as I was experiencing the game of soccer, and as there was this tremendous infusion of soccer into American media starting in the mid-1990s, it was actually happened to coincide with this period where people started to talk a great deal about globalization. And so in my mind, my experience as being a soccer fan was always very interconnected with thinking about globalization. And it was in part because I was experiencing it as a fan, where we suddenly had Rupert Murdoch's Fox Soccer Channel making it possible for us to, or it was called Fox Sports World back then, making it possible for us as fans to watch the English Premier League in Serie A and La Liga on a regular basis. And then you had the internet, which made it so much easier to follow the game. And it just felt to me like my experience as a fan was a pretty good case study in globalization. And then everything that I was seeing on the field was basically just a very clear object lesson in globalization, that you had the global soccer economy booming, and you had players from Africa and South America rushing into the European leagues in great numbers, and you had teams that had tremendous aspirations to become kind of the Walmarts and McDonald's of global soccer. And so the question was, when you had all this change happening, how would that affect the way that people thought about themselves? And I don't think that there's any better proxy for identity than soccer and our teams and the way that we think about our teams. And I think that into my book, I spent about 8 months traveling around the world and trying to collect stories that and tell stories that helped answer this question about how we think about ourselves in a globalized world. And I think that this World Cup shed some pretty interesting case studies of its own onto that question about how we think about ourselves in the global age. And a lot of them are much more encouraging than I would have imagined. And you look at the German team and the way that Germany was able to get behind an incredibly multicultural team with very little rancor back home. That was something that, to be honest, completely surprised me. Or you look at, this World Cup is filled with political storylines, the way in which the French national team imploded. And you do see some of that racial backlash against the multicultural French team. Or the way in which you have Nigeria trying to wrestle with the fact that its soccer federation is thoroughly corrupt and relies on European coaches to come in at the last minute as a crutch to try to keep everything together, is its own interesting little case study. It's one of these books where you wish you could just do a new version of it every couple of years, because it's an ever-changing subject and just incredibly rich.
It is incredibly fascinating, and I do want to foreshadow that the next question I want to talk to you about is maybe how some of these play out within the domestic United States, where I'll cite your friend and mine, Glenn Beck, and his take on the World Cup. But before that, actually, I want to stay on this from a really broad view, just pulling the lens out as far as possible, because 2007, 2008, the world hurtled into this global financial crisis. And in the years since then, there's been something of a crisis in globalized capitalism. And yet the most popular spectacle, global football, the money has just gone up and up and up and up since that point. And I think this has been the biggest World Cup. And that to me is very interesting. And on your themes, again, even around kind of identities that get forged around, say, club fans, fans of Manchester United in India and East Asia, just what your reflections are, given that very broad framing about where soccer fits now into globalization, given this particular crisis that's occurred.
Well, on the one level, I think that you're absolutely right that the growth of the game continues apace and is probably reflective of the reality that globalization is a somewhat implacable force in the world. But on the other hand, the financial crisis has tainted the game, and especially in the English Premier League, which has always been at the vanguard of this escalation in the amount of money that they're paying out and expenses run amok. And one of the interesting ways in which that's manifested itself is that you had, in the past decade, a number of American investors come in and buy the crown jewels of English football, Manchester United and Liverpool, and investing in Arsenal and other clubs across the country. And what you see now is a very interesting backlash in those clubs against their American owners, particularly in Manchester United, where the fans are in full revolt against the Glazer family, which financed the purchase of the team with debt, which is what arguably forced the team to sell Cristiano Ronaldo and prevented them from buying another generation of great players. And Liverpool has its own spectacular financial troubles, which has led to a backlash against the Hicks and Gillette, the owners at that club. And so if I were writing my book now, I would most definitely want to have a chapter about the crisis in English football and all that reveals about globalization.
And in the United States, obviously, the tournament didn't take place here like in 1994. So bracketing the 94 tournament, the response to this was much greater than it's ever been before. The United States played a series of very dramatic games, some of the most exciting games in the tournament, though it's a little hard being here to be entirely have an objective perspective on it relative to other countries. Runs in the tournament. At the very beginning of the tournament, the folks over at Fox News, Glenn Beck in particular, really went after the World Cup. And then they suffered the crisis of what do they do, and everybody's getting behind this national team because, you know, the flag waving and USA, USA, USA is such a
right
thing that things like Fox News want to embrace. But, they called it.
I don't know. Did you ever see the there's a hilarious website that juxtaposed images of Tea Party supporters in their Uncle Sam and Captain America costumes and U.S. soccer supporters, and asked you to decide whether the given photo was of a Tea Party supporter or a USA soccer supporter, and it was very hard to tell them apart.
Was it ever both?
I don't know. I'm sure occasionally it must be.
Yeah. Well, again, the critique, of course, was that it's unmanly, un-American, socialist. Sounds like what they say about Obama. But the things that I think were striking to me was that, yeah, they maybe have something to fear. Because
absolutely. So, I mean, I think that their critique of soccer has always been grounded in fear. Fear that that America's going to lose its exceptional status in the world. And it's a fear of globalization, ultimately, that this is the one great instance where America itself is being globalized. We're so used to the globalization narrative featuring America imposing its culture on the rest of the world. Well, this is one of the instances where the rest of the world is pretty clearly imposing its culture on the United States. And you know what? Americans are receptive to it. And this may sound a little bit strange, but I felt that there were certain parallels in this World Cup between America's reaction to its national team and to the tournament and to the Barack Obama election. And I think that one of the reasons that Americans felt so good about Barack Obama winning was that it felt like somehow we were able to restore our place in the world with his election, and that we were able to reintegrate into the global community after being such pariahs during the Bush era.
Right.
And, you know, when you listen to American fans in South Africa, a lot of them had Yes We Can signs, and you saw Barack Obama T-shirts all over the place. And it did feel like we were part of the reason that I think that you see people feeling so good about our national team this tournament is that they were likable in a way that Barack Obama was likable circa 2008, and that they did do something to kind of heal our global standing in some small but I think measurable way.
In terms of the way that the tournament was received here, I felt that ESPN, Disney, ABC, whatever you want to call them, obviously, they did a huge investment in this, but I was almost instantly pleasantly surprised with the quality of their coverage, of course, compared to what had taken place in previous World Cups. What was your impression on that, and what was your impression on how this played out in not only the American media, but English-language media from around the world, which was then consumed in the United States?
I agree with you entirely about ESPN. I give them kudos. I think that they were stuck with an interesting conundrum, which is you have this game, which they have every financial interest now in growing in this country. So do you try to construct your coverage to appeal to existing soccer fans, or do you try to configure your coverage to try to get you the next soccer fan, to try to recruit new audiences, new demographics to the game? And I think that they focused on presenting the game to people who are already passionate about soccer. And I think that's not just pleasant for those of us who are passionate about the game of soccer, but I think it actually helps grow the game at the end of the day, because people, in order, you know, what makes the great game so sellable is its authenticity, is the sense that you're coming into this world where there are traditions and there is a sophisticated way of thinking about action on the field that doesn't always seem sophisticated to the untrained eye. And so I think ESPN ultimately made a very good case for the game to the newbies who were dropping by for the first time.
Yeah, I thought they combined intelligent soccer analysis with the framings that were going to make it accessible to the general American public that weren't as knowledgeable about the game going into the tournament. And then some of the people that they drew on, you know, Rude Hewlett, Roberto Martinez, and Wigan Athletic is my side in the premiership. And they have been for 5 years since they came up. And the reason is I can't embrace any of the top clubs in England because I'm half Italian, grew up partly in Italy. AS Rome was my club side. So I can't really embrace any of the top sides because they're busy slaughtering my team in the Champions League, because AS Rome always gets, for a while there, was getting beaten up every year by Manchester United in the Champions League. So I wasn't going to root for any of those top four, and I embraced Wigan, and I got to tell you, he's going to get picked up by one of the top clubs soon because he's a heck of a manager. And I
think he's so intelligent, and I thought that his tactical explanations were always dead on and impeccably explained.
Yeah, and for me, as knowing him, and so few people did, the minute I saw him, these guys did their research. I mean, they really got somebody who can talk a fine game. I mean, he was a darling of the British media, so maybe it wasn't that hard of a thing to find. But the fact that they brought him on, obscure club from the British Premiership, it was a really great catch. And a lot of
while we're singing the praises of American media, I think the other outlet that deserves some praise is Sports Illustrated, which I think hired an absolute all-star roster of British soccer writers to cover the game. Jonathan Wilson, who is a writer who's come to a lot of people's attention during the course of this World Cup, was somebody that I'd always read. His book, Inverting the Pyramids, is a spectacular history of tactics, and he's just he has an incredible ability to read the game. And then Tim Vickery, who writes about the South American game, was recruited by Sports Illustrated, a very savvy hire. Gabriele McCarty, all around, I think that SI had extremely high quality, sophisticated writing about the tournament.
Yeah, Raphael Honigstein too on Germany was great over there at SI.com and elsewhere if you picked up his writings. Franklin Foyer, author of How Soccer Explains the World, an Unlikely Theory of Globalization. I just want to end with the biggest possible question, which is soccer in the world right now. And answer this however you like. What do you make of it that at this point in human history, the biggest cultural event, the one thing that really unifies and brings us together is the World Cup soccer tournament, just in the broadest strokes possible? What do you think that says about humanity right now in 2010?
Ian Buruma, the Dutch, American, English journalist, has argued that football has essentially replaced religion in European society with its ceremony and the way that it provides some metaphysical grounding for the continent. And I think that he's kind of on to something. I mean, in the rest of the world where religion is still very much a real force, I mean, I don't know if you could quite describe it as playing exactly that kind of role. But I think that we are in a realm where the game's significance and the way that people think about themselves and live their lives is just immense. I mean, it really does play an outsized role. And there's really nothing on the planet that can compare to it. And its existence is a complicated one. It's caught up in the machinery of multinational capitalism. It's intertwined with the forces of migration, and nationalism, and the complexities of our national identities in an age where there is so much migration and people's national identities are complicated by the fact that they're part of larger organisms like the European Union. And so, you know, I don't think that there's any sort of simple way to sum up the role that the game has in our lives, except to say that it's large and outsized and helps get you to the nub of the way that we live now.
Franklin Foyer is the editor of The New Republic. You can find his writings on the website www.tnr.com. Has a great blog there called Goalposts, revolving around the 2010 World Cup. And he is the author of the book How Soccer Explains the World in Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Franklin Foyer, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game.
My pleasure.